Okay, this is our final hour to go. We'll take your calls with Bill Blunden, author of Behold a Pale Farce, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Bill Blunden with us, of course. And Bill, of all the things you've researched to date, what's the one part that scares you, or should I say creates the anxiety?
To see where our republic is headed in terms of its kind of internal power structures and what is actually driving the policy making in Washington. I think that is it's something I've kind of searched for a long time, and to finally, you know, there have been other people who've studied it too. For example, there have been sociologists like C. Wright Mills. He wrote a book called The Power Elite. And even as far back as in 1937, there was a journalist named Ferdinand Lundberg who wrote a book called America's 60 Families, where he basically, his thesis is that these 60 families really are making the decisions, the important ones, and framing the debate that the rest of society is going on. And more recently, if you want to go to kind of contemporary sociologists, there's a guy from UC Santa Cruz. His name is G. William Domhoff, who has also studied this in depth. And so I think that recently there was some work done by a Princeton professor named Martin Gillens and another one named Benjamin Page from Northwestern. They're both political scientists, and they had a paper called Testing Theories of American Politics. And what they discovered was that the government primarily responds to the business elites and organized groups that represent business interests. This has really disturbing implications to it in terms of, you know, and it for me, it ties in completely to the issue of cyber war also, because it means that this kind of is why things are being framed the way they are and how the propaganda ties into things to kind of get us to go along. The idea that, you know, every time you look on the TV or hear the word cyber war, or you hear messages about the power grid or the financial system, I think that kind of crystallized thing, that was kind of the diamond cut that really put all the pieces together for me. So I think that, you know, the United States as a republic is kind of in trouble. You hear the word oligarch. Even if you're reading the New York Times, you'll read the word oligarch when they talk about the Ukraine. You'll hear the word oligarch when they talk about Russia.
And that's what we are now.
For some reason, you never hear anyone in the United States referred to as an oligarch. But, you know, the New York Times just this past weekend published a list of CEO salaries, you know, and Larry Ellison was at the top, so like $70 million. But you know what? Even those CEOs are small potatoes compared to the private equity hedge fund people.
Oh,
those people, they make billions of dollars, right?
In and out. Yep.
Right. But, you know, we never hear, it's almost as though it's forbidden to use the word oligarch. You'll never, you know, the only person who might use it, it might be in the op-ed section under Paul Krugman, but that's about it. So I think this is kind of an issue. It's kind of a global issue. I think a lot of nations struggle with this. Even us, it's just that we don't realize it. I think that because, you know, there's this propaganda, this propaganda model is at work here. People are distracted with consumption. You know, they have their digital devices that they sit there and diddle all day long, and they watch reality TV and what have you, and they're not seeing this. There's a description for this. There's a Princeton professor, his name is Sheldon Wolin. He called it inverted totalitarianism. The idea that instead of being like normal fascism where you mobilize the public, you actually have this disengaged public that's just not even a part of the decision-making process. They've just walked away, basically. They're distracted. They're oblivious, and they just, you know, they're not part of the real decision-making. And so I think that if you say a disturbing development that I've seen, this is it. This is, and because of what it portends in terms of other things like climate change or the future of our middle class, or even cybersecurity. I think ultimately cybersecurity is much more than just a technical problem, although some people try to frame it that way. You know, there's definitely technical aspects, but there are also economic aspects, and even more importantly, there are political aspects that have a lot to do. Yeah.
Let's go to Ron in Fresno, California, west of the Rockies. Hey, Ron, get us started. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Good.
Hey, I got a couple questions I'd like to have answered.
Sure.
How much was it that Camilla Harris got for California in that lawsuit against the banks and the home loans and mortgage companies? And how come Governor Brown dipped into it and took money to balance his budgets? You know, I mean, what gives him the right to do that? And who does the money really go to when it's all said and done? And is it a possible scenario that Camilla Harris forms a committee that and hires her cronies for the big salary positions, you know, to dole out the money, and the longer they keep it, the more interest it gains, and who gets that? Anyways, that was my questions.
I don't know who gets that money, and I don't know how much she got. Are you familiar with that, Bill?
I'm afraid that's outside my area of expertise. I'll have to defer to you, George.
Okay, and I was going to defer to you. So I can't do that one. But maybe somebody will have some information about it.
Hey, Google it.
You never know.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go to Eric in Denver, Colorado. Eric, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
First, I'd like to thank you for your time. How are you?
Sure. Good. I hope you're well, too.
Doing great. I have three things I wanted to mention. The first thing is, would you consider drone strikes a cyber war of some sort? My second question, on the other hand, would also be about the national security law and how it does affect, like, the American citizen and their security, because I believe that a lot of people fear for whatever reason, and they are willing to give up their security for their freedom.
Yes.
And I don't think that's the appropriate action to take.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the bioweapons are definitely a different category. It's a different domain, I think, completely. It's kind of in the kinetic sphere. It's in the physical sphere. It's not a digital phenomenon. I think that the one common, if you wanted to draw commonalities between them, I would say that they're both more available to countries that have fewer resources. I mean, nuclear weapons, you really do need this huge infrastructure to develop and to enrich the uranium and to actually develop and develop the expertise to work with the plutonium and to make weapons out of it. Whereas with biological weapons, it doesn't necessarily, there's a lower barrier to entry, and I think it's the same way with cyber weapons. There's a much lower barrier to entry, and you know, it's I think with bioweapons, it's a little easier to do. Because it's easier to hide the fact that you're developing them. For example, in 1972, when Nixon signed the treaty with Russia for the Biological Weapons Convention, basically the Russians took that as a sign that they should run ahead and start, you know, developing all these new weapons, because we would have stopped doing our own program. So and they actually did that, and we only found out about it because there was a leak. There was an anthrax leak in one of the in some city. I think it was Fairlanx. I'm not sure exactly if I got the name of that city right. But and with cyber weapons, it's kind of the same way. It's very easy to hide cyber weapon development. And so, in terms of enforcing like arms treaties, it's really kind of problematic. And it's somewhat the same way with biological weapons too. You can kind of do it quietly and without much of a signature. I think there are at least some common threads. As far as security and liberty, and people being scared to give up liberty to get security, I'm not sure I understand that question.
Well, and let me ask you this. Would you consider it an act of war if we were attacked cyber-wise?
I think that it depends. It depends. You know, war is a violent act that has it's a political means to an end, typically between nation states. So for me, an act of war is, you know, it's going to be really violent, and there's going to have to be there will have to be, you know, a significant amount of bloodshed. I.e. the bombing of Dresden, something on that scale. I think that a denial of service attack, you know, just doesn't come close. And I think that Bill Clinton actually gave a brilliant response. Someone was talking about a denial of service attack being some sort of digital Pearl Harbor, and he stood back. And this is great. I love this. He stood back and he said, look, you've got to remember in Pearl Harbor, we lost our Pacific Fleet. You know, 2,000 some people died. You know, denial of service, just not in the same ballpark. So I think it really depends upon what happens as a result of the cyber attack. I think that, you know, sabotage and spying, you know, it's not the same thing as an act of war. I think it really, and some people would say, you know what, we need to expand our definition of war. And the Chinese have this idea of total war where it's basically everything. And I'm thinking I can hear the inner party of Oceania from 1984, you know, in the background, you know, so war is peace, you know, war is everything, everything is war, and it's everywhere and all the time and perpetual. And I just think that's a ridiculous idea. I think, you know, we have these definitions for a reason. If you're gonna diagnose an illness, you've got to be able to take the symptoms and classify them and then treat them accordingly. And you can't just smother everything as war and just leave it at that. And, you know, what would you expect from a quasi-police state like China, you know? So,
What about chipping? Do you think one day they're going to force us all to try to get chips in our palms of our hands?
Oh, God, I hope not.
I see that happening. The forcing, at least.
I can see it. I can see, at least at this time and place, I can see wealthy people doing it. Maybe to protect their children from kidnapping or something. I know that, you know, if you look at China, things are so unstable for the leadership there. Occasionally they eat each other that, you know, the goal of every oligarch in China is to make their money as quickly as possible and then to get out of the country and go somewhere more stable. And that, I think, somewhat explains why the real estate markets in Manhattan and London
Huge.
Are being eaten up by these oligarchs from China and Russia. And well, another thing that they do is they send their kids to school abroad.
Yes, they do.
So that if
Smart.
Anything happens, you know,
the kids are okay.
The kids are okay. So I can kind of see chipping, you know, used for, I think pets maybe are a better kind of current use. I hope that it doesn't come to that, because if it does, it's going to be real trouble.
Are you biblical at all?
I'm more of a Taoist than I am kind of a Christian. So I grew up as an Anglican, so I have a
little background.
Understanding, yeah, but
so if I said the sign of the beast, what would you say?
I don't know. I mean,
JW in Louisville, Kentucky. Go ahead, JW.
Oh, hi, George. I wanted to say, you asked Bill why hacking has become so prevalent, and I just wanted to say that I think in part it's because our politicians have not demanded competition in the software industry. I mean, you had one software company dominate the market for 20 or 30 years, and there was never any incentive to build security into the software until we the internet came along in the mid-90s, and then that was left up to other companies like Symantec and McAfee and those kind of, you know. But I think this is a great example of how monopoly is. A monopoly can harm us in the long run. And I think had there been competition for the last 20 or 30 years, there would have been incentive to build security into the operating systems and the home computers like, you know, that we have. That is, what do you think about that, Bill? Do you think it's...
Well, I definitely agree with you. I think that Microsoft really got a hold on a lot of government departments. For example, they recently signed a $617 billion contract with the Department of Defense.
$617 billion?
Billion, yeah. I'm sorry, $617 million.
Million.
I'm sorry,
That's
I got
okay.
that wrong. Actually, yeah, it's
a zero.
It's in the same ballpark as the Amazon's agreement with the CIA. They had a $600 million agreement with the CIA to provide cloud services. So Microsoft, again, with the Department of Defense, had a licensing agreement. It was around $617 million. If you want to go to billions, you'd probably have to go to Lockheed. In 2012, they had roughly $23 billion worth of revenue come in from their government contracts. So this is big business for these companies.
It's huge, and they need to do it every year because they've got to top the previous year.
But as a result of having this income from these contracts, they have money and they use it to lobby. I mean, Microsoft has this huge bank that it just sits on, and that is billions of dollars. It's just a mountain of cash, and they can purchase influence in D.C. And when the government threatened to go to Linux, Microsoft went on a rampage and pulled out all the stops and stopped it cold in its tracks. And it shows you again the kind of influence that can be purchased. And you know, Microsoft is a company which, you know, it traditionally they have these incentives to push out new products with new features rather than to go back and to tack on and to really make their product secure audit as effectively as they do add new features. But you know, they've supposedly had an assurance program. I think it's called the Secure Development Lifecycle. But even with this assurance model in place and this methodology that supposedly they're following, we still have this steady stream of critical bugs that come out every month. And so you have to kind of wonder how serious are they really, when even when they have this assurance process, that they still have all these critical bugs coming out. So I really think that, you know, that this is a place where the market has failed, and Microsoft doesn't bear the cost of the incidents that result from its bugs. Not to mention that, you know, it's actually documented now that they cooperate with the NSA and give them early access to some of their flaws so that the NSA knows about it in advance.
So they're all in cahoots with each other.
Yeah, I mean, people talk about being worried about why I should, you know, why I'm worried about the NSA spying. But it's also corporate spying is also pretty, and corporate data collection can be pretty, pretty insidious. And the reason for this is that they have reasons to cooperate with the government. I mean, not every business cooperates with the government like Alphabet. They would rather go out of business than collaborate. But for a lot of the larger companies like Amazon or Microsoft, they have reasons. You know, there are, you know, reasonable factors that influence the decision-making process when they do this cost-benefit in terms of whether they cooperate or not. And, you know, for example, the dividing line in the national security state between the private and public sector is pretty much nil, which means there's huge financial incentives for them to cooperate because they stand to get these contracts. And some of these companies also have legislative needs, like the social networking sites. They make their money by monetizing user data. So they take this data, they collect it, and they sell it.
Yeah.
So the more data they can collect, the more they can sell, the more money they make. So they have every reason to want to dilute privacy laws.
That's a good point.
So they have legislative needs. And then to top it all off, some of these companies have their own in-house security sections that preemptively cooperate with the government.
Bill, we're going to come back in just a moment. We're going to take final phone calls with you right here on Coast to Coast AM with our guest, Bill Blunden. Behold a pale farce. On our next Coast to Coast program, it's Richard C. Hoagland and all things space. So get ready for that. We've got a great list of shows for you this week, as we do all the time. We're going to come back in a moment. We'll take final phone calls with Bill Blunden. Behold a pale farce. Welcome back with Bill Blunden as we talk about his work, Behold a Pale Farce. Do you think that if there is a cyber attack, it'll come from some rogue group as opposed to a nation?
It's hard to tell. I mean, we get attacked by rogue groups all the time. They're criminal groups, and they attack us. They attack businesses. They attack people. Sometimes they're just opportunistic. So I think there are attacks all over the place. They happen all the time. They're fairly pedestrian. And I think that, you know, it really is a combination of just raw crime and then espionage, too. In terms of the effect, it's the cumulative effect, again, I said, is kind of a significant. I think if, as far as, let's take the other approach, let's say a nation state, if they do attack, I think there's going to be problems just in terms of just identifying who the attacker is. And this is one of the Achilles heel and the whole idea of deterrence. You know, for deterrence to work, you've got to be able to attribute the attack to somebody. You've got to say, you know, if you've got to retaliate against
somebody. Oh, yeah, you got to know who you're going to retaliate against.
Yeah, and it just so happens that national governments, in addition to corporations in the private sector, have been heavily involved in developing anti-forensic tools to foil the whole process of attribution. For example, there's a company called Intrepid, and they have this service. It's called an Internet Operations Network. It's basically this huge cloud of machines, which supposedly, when you use it, allows you what they call operational non-attribution. In other words, you can do it anonymously. You can do something anonymously. And the reason that governments develop this is they want to be able to spy on other people, and they want to do so anonymously. So the whole idea of having deterrence is kind of a waste, because these governments, our government has done it. I'm pretty sure we have. We've funded stuff like Tor. You know, Tor was originally founded on the need to spy anonymously.
Yeah, that's right.
The onion routing technology that it's based on that's really the driving force behind it. So I think the whole idea of deterrence then becomes kind of a waste of money. You know, why spend all this money developing offensive technology if another country is going to attack you? They're probably not going to do it in a way where you can figure out who it is. And so this kind of ends up being a waste of money. But you know what? Waste is something the military excels at. You know, every year the Government Accounting Office tries to audit the Pentagon, and they say, you know what, we can't do it. That's right. And since 1996, the Pentagon's wasted something like $8.5 trillion. That's almost the annual GDP of China. So waste is no stranger to the military. So maybe they don't care. You know, hey, you know, something must be done. This is something. Let's do it.
Let's go to the phones. Robert in Bakersfield, California. Hello, Robert. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yep.
I was wondering, it's an honor to meet you, by the way, but I was wondering if you ever got to meet William Cooper?
Unfortunately, no, I never got to meet Mr. Cooper. I just happened upon his book when I was thinking of a title, and I realized that he had seized the title before I had. And so I actually just was able to glance through the book a little bit and look at it. But I've never had the opportunity to meet him.
Died in 2001, November 5th, and I never had an opportunity to meet him either. And he created quite a stir with some of his work.
Yes. I think one thing that struck me about the book was the artwork. It really seemed, I was really drawn to it for some reason. It seemed really unique. I mean, especially for a book of that nature. I think it kind of really makes the book stand out. And it held my attention, definitely.
Let's go to Kate in Concrete, Washington, first time caller. Kate, good morning.
Yes, I have two things. Who still believes in a democratic society, and how do we get people to believe in reality instead of watching reality on TV? I'll take my answers off the air.
Okay. So do I still believe in democracy? Absolutely. I think, you know, I strongly believe in the ideals that our republic was founded on. We don't have a democracy per se in this country. We have a republic. We have a constitution. We have a Bill of Rights. We have all sorts of things that were set up so that there wasn't just a sheer democracy. In fact, there are arguments you could make that the founding fathers were kind of nervous about democracy a little bit, and they created institutions and things set up so that it would kind of limit democracy a little bit. But I do believe in democratic participation, I think your second question is, well, what are we going to do if people are so distracted? How do you kind of wake them up from this propaganda-fueled slumber? And I think that really the only way is going to be, the only way to kind of recapture things, I think, is going to be education. You have to, you know, people who know have to spread the word. The best antidote for propaganda is exposure. You know, expose it to the truth, expose it to sunlight. You know, that's what happens when lies hit sunlight. You put bleach on them and they dissolve. So I think, you know, it really comes down to spreading and educating. I don't see violent overthrow as a realistic option. First of all, because we would be completely outgunned, and second of all, because I don't think we would be able to match the brutality of the forces we would go up against. So I think that peaceful education and direct civil disobedience and direct action and organizing and developing channels where people can, you know, develop institutions and learn from their mistakes and develop institutional knowledge. I think that that's really going to be the way to go. And history kind of hints to us how this has happened before. There have been groups of people who have taken on entrenched power structures in our society and have made progress that has allowed people to participate in ways they hadn't in the past. I'm talking about women's suffrage. I'm talking about the Civil Rights Act. I'm talking about the GI Bill. I'm talking about the Wagner Act. So, you know, I think that history offers lessons as to how this happens. I think the problem is that a lot of times these lessons get forgotten and they have to be relearned. And this is my own personal opinion, but I see this growing inequality in our country. I think that it is very dangerous, and the problem is people aren't paying attention to it, and it's just going to keep getting worse. The after World War II, there was an opposing ideology overseas. You know, as flawed as it was, it represented an alternative. And because of that alternative, the people kind of who were in charge of things over here realized that if they didn't allow the average person to share in the prosperity of post-World War II America, where we were the only industrial power on the planet left intact, that we would be tempted to explore alternatives. And now that alternative is pretty much gone. Now the new state religion is market fundamentalism. And so this inequality that I see is just going to get worse and worse. And eventually it's going to get to the point where people will start to mobilize because they don't have any alternative and they'll be desperate. And at that point, when people start to mobilize, I think we'll start to see what this mass interception is really all about.
When this entire field of cyber technology gets even bigger in 5 years or 10 years, then what do we do? What kind of safeguards will we have in place?
We'll have to have political safeguards and maybe some technical ones too, but these are, you know, ostensibly the government is here to kind of work as a buffer between us and the powerful interests outside of government, and to set ground rules, and to set regulation. I already see Google Glasses and it kind of freaks me out. I already see that. And I think the whole logo of Don't Be Evil, I'm not buying that at all. The reason that this cooperation between the private sector and the public sector is so unnerving is that the scale of it is so massive. Something like the data broker industry and the data aggregator industry dwarfs anything that the NSA does, right? It's something like $200 billion a year in revenue. And this is an industry that often prefers profits over privacy. And so they're developing technology. You know, a lot of these companies are talking about drones. And that is also very alarming to me. To give you an example, in the past, it's documented that Yahoo has assisted the Chinese government in identifying people who would make critical remarks against the government. And Microsoft supposedly has altered Skype so that governments like Russia can decode, decrypt, and monitor Skype sessions. And so, again, I said that this is because these industries, they're basically, they have this fiduciary duty to generate profit, and that comes before the notion of civil liberties, I think. And so they're developing this technology, and in light of that, that is, I think, very disturbing. I think we have to be very careful, and there need to be rules so that we can protect our civil liberties. I think they're going to become more and more encroached upon, and there's going to be more pressure. I think that, you know, when cell phones first came out, it used to be a very small kind of insignificant choice. Do I want a cell phone or don't I want a cell phone? And it got to the point where eventually, you know, that small choice became a big choice. And now it's like, do I want to participate in society or don't I? You pretty much need a cell phone nowadays to interact with everyone else. And I think I see this technology kind of going the same way. It's very disturbing. You know, it's a small choice now. Do I want to be part of this social media platform, or don't I? And will it get to the point where now it's a big choice? Now it's not just a small choice. It's something fundamental. Do I want to participate in society or don't I? So that's kind of where I see it being headed. These companies want to monetize your data, and they just want more of it because more data means more money for
sure
them.
Sure does.
Yeah.
All right. Next up, let's go to Chase in Houston, Texas. Chase, good morning.
Hi. Can you guys hear me?
Yep, sure can.
Sure. Hi. So I learned to hack computers at a very early age because my family, I grew up around electricians and messing around with electronic components and stuff. And programming logic just kind of fell easily for me. And it was really easy to break into websites. I mean, SQL injections are so prevalent. It's very easy to get credit card information out of so many websites on the internet. So I don't think it's just governments we need to worry about. It's other citizens as well, even little kids.
Yep.
What can we do about it when embedded devices can have kind of ring zero rootkits that reinitialize and reinstall themselves on whatever hard drives are inserted in the machine? I guess, what are your thoughts on that, Bill?
Yeah, I think I get your point. It's like this subversion is so deep and so pervasive. It's like, what can you possibly do about it? The reason they get away with this is because they're allowed to get away with it, because they can entice companies to cooperate with them, and because these programs are allowed to occur. This is a problem that impacts our entire society, and our entire society is being put at risk as a result of it. And like I said, what we're doing is worse than what we're accusing other countries of doing, because what we're doing is, with our mass interception and our subversion programs, is we're undermining the collective security and privacy of everyone. Can you imagine how someone, I mean, supposedly there are some laws and rules to protect us here in the United States. Can you imagine how someone in a foreign country feels? They are monitored by this all-seeing eye that has no limits and no accountability, and there's not much they can do about it. I mean, imagine how we would respond in the United States if we found out another country was doing that to us. I think we would go nuts. So I think that this is really, you know, what the NSA is doing is really dangerous and destructive. And it's basically security for the 1%. They're doing this so that a small group of spies can collect intelligence. And the question is, well, why do they need to collect this intelligence? And I think that Ed Snowden probably put it best. You know, in an open letter to Brazil, he said, this is the major goals of this mass interception. It's economic spying, diplomatic manipulation, and social control. In other words, it's all about power. And I think
about power.
Yeah, he hit the nail on the head. And there's so much proof now. You know, the NSA watching monitoring oil companies in Brazil and the Middle East, you know, tracking money transfers through SWIFT and transactions, credit card transactions, and watching people at environmental summits and economic summits. There's definitely diplomatic manipulation going on. And at home, I think we have kind of the same situation. The ACLU had a report where they argued we're pretty sure that they're watching and monitoring political dissent. And it makes sense, because we have this program with drones where we kill people based on a vague signature in other countries. And we have torture sites in other countries. Why would it somehow be out of bounds to monitor political activists? And sure enough, there's evidence that they're actually monitoring political activists. You know, 2009, there was a report that became public about the Army and other agencies infiltrating and monitoring anti-war activists in Washington. In 2013, the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security released documents showing that they, in addition to other local agencies and some corporate security sectors, had been watching the Occupy movement. And then here, close to home, in Oakland, there's something called a Domain Awareness Center that they put up. And ostensibly, it was put up for to fight crime. But it turns out the documents that have been released by activists show that this really, it's not so much about preventing crime as it is about monitoring labor strikes and nonviolent political activists. And that was really disturbing when I found that. I was like, oh no, it's starting. And so I think that, you know, this is a problem that that affects all of us. And unfortunately, the way that the NSA is going about it, they're doing it in a way that it's really enhancing their own control. And it's taking away liberty from us and security from us.
Whittling away, Bill. Bill, we're out of time, but good luck and thanks. And Behold a Pale Farce, the book is available now?
At Barnes & Noble. It's also available at the publisher's website, Trinday. I think they have a $5 off sale. And you can go to Amazon, too.
And we've got a link for you on your website, so you're all covered.
Thank you for having me on, George. It's been a lot of fun.
All right, you take care of yourself. Bill Blunden. He does not believe that there's going to be a cyber war. Of course, we got your take on some of that as well. Those of you, the rest of you who've been on hold for so long, I am so sorry, but we're just simply out of time. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lydasour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there, on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.